galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Good day, wherever you are in this world. I hope you're having a great day here listening to Revolution Radio. Everybody asked for this. Revolution Radio. Where the information never sleeps.
This hat
from aluminum foil, where it had this foil lined in case an alien's inclined to probe your butt or read your mind. Looks a bit peculiar. Seems a little crazy, but someday I'll prove there's a big conspiracy.
Welcome to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's 2 a.m. on the East Coast of the United States. I have no idea what time it is down and under, but it is time for Shiny Side Out with Dave and Mecki. So I hope you have your tinfoil hat all made and cinched down tight over your ears. So take it away, Dave and Mecki.
And Mecki's to read the intro. Please proceed, Mecki.
Hello and welcome to Shiny Side Out with
Dave
and Mecki on WCCR, broadcasting from Australia for Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and revolution.radio, where it's more than just radio. So jump in the chat room if you can. This is show number 444, believe it or not. Oh, my goodness. Talking about physical evidence. Physical evidence, we're still talking about that because it's interesting stuff to talk about. And, it's going to be fascinating today, I think, for you guys. It's on air, online, and on your smart device, so grab an app to listen anywhere or listen at home on a great tabletop digital radio. And if you missed Solaris' show, which I did, which you shouldn't have, but it was an awesome show, with Drew Hurst Beeson, and his book is Paratrooper of Fortune, right? And they were discussing his book there. And if you get a chance to listen to it, just go ahead and become a subscriber to the Freedom Slips Archives. It costs you $5 a month. $5 a month. No longer free, I'm afraid. It's now $5 a month. But if you are going to subscribe, you can listen to all of our shows, to our shows, to all the hosts' shows. Going back, well, I think, Dave, 10 odd years now, right? I think it is. Now, before we proceed, though, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land. For me, it's the Darug people here in Pemulwuy, and for Dave,
it's the Dakanil.
Dave. And we would like to pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. Interestingly enough, I think we're becoming more aware of just how well the First Nations people anywhere in the world, really, but in Australia specifically, have taken care of the land. I've been watching a lot of reports recently around a cultural burning, Dave. Cultural burning forests. So we're talking about forest management here, right? So obviously, forest fires, especially in Australia, nothing new. In fact, the flora, you know, all our trees and bushes, etc., are designed to thrive in fire. In fact, they need to, some of the plants need fire to spread their seed, as it
they
were.
They require it.
100%. They have to have it. So, the heat of the fire will open the seed pods, sometimes in an explosive fashion, catapulting seeds far afield. So fire is an integral part of the natural cycle in Australia, as it is in other parts of the world. What we're seeing now, though, of course, these fires are not really as natural as they used to be. They're much too frequent, much too large, and much too hot, believe it or not. But it appears that the Aborigines of Australia had a really good way of managing the forest. It's called cultural burning or cultural forest management, and it's being brought back on the eastern seaboard here in Australia more and more. Because the truth is. The officials that are running your forest management, et cetera, so they're running out of ideas. It's that simple. What else can we do here, right? Hey, let's see what the Aborigines did. And that makes sense. All these backburning, all the things they used to do makes perfect sense. And you know what? Maybe we should look to the native peoples elsewhere as well to manage our forests. Because right now, yes, there are fires burning in the northwestern United States quite severely, as well as other places of the world. But the worst place of fires right now is in Siberia, believe it or not. Siberia has got the worst fires right now. They're massive. They're even dwarfing the Australian fires of last year. Massive
really?
Fires. Oh, yeah. They're huge. They're much bigger than what we had. And it's tundra. And what we're seeing, there's a shift from tundra, which is a permafrost, if you will, to now, it's no longer permafrost, it's thawing, and it stays thawing as well. It might freeze a little in winter, but then it thaws again, and it releases methane gas and a whole bunch of other greenhouse gases, but methane, of course, being the most prevalent. So it's a real problem. It's a real problem. So we are in a cycle where we're no longer seeing weather changes, but we're seeing climate changes happening. Again, climate change is not a new thing, guys. Not a new thing. Been happening for tens, hundreds, millions of years. Tens of millions of years, and climates have changed, come and gone, and it's just a thing that the Earth goes through. Are humans to blame? Well, I'm sure there's, human activity could be an accelerating factor. It doesn't mean the climate change wouldn't have come anyway. When we might even be going through a cosmic cloud dust here, which might, change the quality of the sunlight. Who knows? Point is, climate change is a thing, okay? Not the weather. The weather is not changing. It will, but the climate is changing, which means the long-term weather patterns are changing, and we have to get used to it. What does it mean? It means that our temperature ranges will change. It means precipitation will change. Rainfall, snowfall, etc. The relative humidity, etc., will change. Flooding patterns will change. All the things that we are used to as weather every day will change. Longer summers, shorter summers, depending on where you are in the world, right? Colder winters, hotter winters. A whole raft of things. The least amount of change we can expect is probably around the equator. Probably. I mean, there will be change there too, but it will be the least amount of change. That's my opinion only. But we will see significant changes at either end of the poles, North Pole, South Pole. That's where the biggest change will come from. However, that's my little spiel on the weather. Dave, how have you been, my friend?
Yeah, been good. I see a lot of stuff. I read a lot of. I suppose my life, except for work and or my family commitments, I am now just a news intake device. That's all I do. I just examine news from all around the world, and I try and get a balanced view and understand the slant from each of the providers. Some of them you're pre-known. Your Foxes and your Sky News in Australia or your CNNs, left or right, not respectively, just left or right or center, or they come from a different place entirely, some even imaginary. That's all I'm doing outside of all my other commitments, and I'm finding that there's some news that, and this is what I sort of gather for each week that we do our show. And I post streams of stuff on Facebook, and some of my friends love it and some hate it. Oh, hang on. I'll play that. I've got a clip that went live to Facebook. Sorry, to YouTube to send. Sorry. I've noticed, just to do with the virus. So I've got, Mackie, I've got the screen of the Johns Hopkins viral data, and I've been tracking it myself, and I do it daily. And the Bhutan had 1,600. I think I mentioned last week 1,600. I think it was deaths. Oh, no, just the count, the case count went down by 1,600. It had been climbing so slowly and steadily over time, and then suddenly it dropped. And someone's doing something, and or they've defined it differently or whatever, right? Yeah. Maybe there was a whole cruise ship that just cruised away from there, from Bhutan. It's probably landlocked. I got to throw that in as a caveat. I don't know where these agendas are coming from. I still hesitate to believe some countries' numbers. Like, there's no North Korea referenced. Kim Jong-un is, not to be seen. His sister, seems to have floated to the top, according to the imaginary news that we get out of there, because who knows what's real. Remember that they did say they won the World Series. Right, even though they don't compete in it, they still won. Well, that was their government's talk to the people to talk it up. So, but have you, having said that, Mackie, the global cases is 30.6 mil, and the global deaths, I've been predicting that the 20th September, except for a slight downfall, and I'm not saying it's disappointing. Just that the trending from about a month ago showed around about today would be the million mark for global deaths, but we are sitting at 955,800. We're pretty close, maybe 5 days out. So that means that the global death rate has started to decline somewhat, which is good to see. I'm not an advocate of the deaths, but I've got a graph on the screen that shows the global deaths started actually declining. So over the last month, that's where the figures started to skew just a little bit. But that's a good thing. But what we're seeing, Mackie, I think we're seeing, except for India and Spain and a couple of other countries that are exponential, we're seeing, even in the US, we are seeing a decline in the case numbers. Mm-hmm. Now, Mackie, this week here in Australia, a professor of virology within Australia's territories said that Australia probably had 60,000 unreported cases of SARS-CoV-2, otherwise known in the media incorrectly as COVID-19. They said 60,000. And it's like, wow, that's a lot. If we've got 26 now, that's pretty high then. And my thoughts were that I think they're trying to restate the case of the severity of the virus. Or, if you do the math, that would bring our case fatality rate down to like 1%. Because we're currently at 3.5%.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, look, when it comes to these numbers, and this is a general statement.
But that's an IFR, not a CFR. I'm providing CFR case numbers. Confirmed.
Exactly. And that's really where we're going here, confirmed. So roughly, and if you look at the total numbers, roughly 10% of all tested people, between 8 and 10% have COVID-19, roughly, thereabouts, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Some have 5%, some are slightly higher, but let's level in around 8 to 10%. Now, then you can only know for sure if someone has been tested. That's the caveat here, right? If you haven't tested someone, you don't know if they have it or don't have it. And another thing is, once you have been tested, doesn't mean you can't get it again, right? That's really critical to understand as well. So, but let's go with the tested one. But if you overlay that, we now had a lot of tests, Dave. We had a couple hundred million tests easily, mm-hmm. if not more, in the world. I mean, in America alone, I think we had. Let me just double check the number here. We had almost 100 million tests in America alone, 60 million in India, another 40 million odd in Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the highest tested nations. Mm-hmm. Australia is pretty good as well, believe it or not. In China, apparently 160 million people were tested.
That's right.
Impressive. That's very impressive. But the point here is, so you can only tell for sure, of course, if someone has been tested. That's when you know. But let's say 10% of people have it. Okay? So globally, 700 million odd people would have it then. That would be the number, right? Thereabouts. Because it's in every country now. Right? And maybe once everybody gets tested, we understand that, you know, the infected number by now is close to a billion. Mm-hmm. Once everybody's tested. And the death rate then, obviously, you also have to multiply by probably, you know, 10, maybe more, right? So instead of a million dead, you get 10, maybe 30, maybe 40 million dead by now. We will only know this in retrospect. We will only know those numbers once we can do some, histographic studies looking back.
Well, they're also mentioning, Mickey, the professor was mentioning that the different kind of test. So was it CPAT or not, something at the moment or something? Mm. And the other one would be for antibodies.
Yeah.
Not for the actual virus DNA, but for antibodies to show that you had it. Yeah. But you're fine now, relatively fine, whatever that means, whatever fine means. Yeah. And according to, I think it's, I forget the country name now, Spain, I think it might be Spain again, or Chile, who have said they're not going to count anyone actually recovering anymore.
Okay.
So, and they haven't been counting them for, to be honest, a long time.
Spain don't care, not counting them.
Yeah, Spain. I think, Spain. So Spain stopped counting recovered people at 150,376. And they're now at infected as 640,000, having had it. But they're not saying, they stopped reporting the people who have been declared to recovered because they don't know what recovered means.
Right.
And do you end up with thrombosis long term? Was that truly the cause? Maybe the cause of the thrombosis all along was having a very similar viral effect in your blood, where it the virus daisy chains your blood vessels together and you get clots. And that's one of the things that this virus SARS-CoV-2 does. But given that the virus CFR, the case fatality rate, is actually dropping now, it's lower than 5% now. It's like 4.3% globally, and still falling. If we'd performed more tests earlier, it would be significantly lower, because those people would have just been asymptomatic and they never really became truly infected, although they had antibodies for it. So there's something to be said about that. And then the secondary, and I'm only questioning this because it keeps coming up in the media, Mackie, all the time, and that is people dying with the virus doesn't mean they died because of the virus. That should also be truly understood. So they're listing people who have died with the virus but not as cause of death, as a death due to the virus at the moment, right? So anyone who dies who has the virus is just ticked, because they're never going to do an autopsy, and there's not going to be a coroner's report on the cause of death. They're just going to go, if you're really old, you just died, right? You remember Groundhog Day, that the bag man. People just get old and they just die. Not today, he says. And doesn't matter what you do, they're still going to die anyway. And look, I don't want to sound terribly right-wing, like I don't care. That's not true. It's absolutely not the case at all. I'm just being very careful in how I mention this, because there is a lot of, the cancel culture is leaping on anybody who says the wrong things. And this is a direct...
Sorry, what culture?
It's called the cancel culture.
Okay, I haven't heard of that. Can you explain that for a second?
Yeah.
Because that sounds interesting.
Yeah, you don't want anything to be part of you, right? You don't want to be part of it or to happen upon you. Now, what happens is a mob... I'm not going to call them the 50 Cent Army, because that's the CCP version of people online, but there is a group of people online who are looking for things that you say historically online. There it is again. And what they're doing is they're finding reasons to have you cancelled online. and delete it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I got you. So essentially all your Facebook accounts or whatever, YouTube accounts will be deleted, etc., right?
You just go offline. That's the end of you.
Wow.
Your online presence is gone. And imagine this in a socially aware justice system where you just disappear. You're no longer online, you're no longer contactable, you can't make an account, your social security number or whatever, what have you, right, for your relevant country is then used then to gain access and admission and benefits in society. Well, if that's all gone, good luck. So there's actually people getting around and undermining people's perfectly good careers now, given that they, especially if I made a joke, about Joe Rogan, for instance, laughing at something that seemed a little insensitive today, where it wasn't so much 5 years ago or 10 years ago. He laughed, but it wasn't like he made the joke and it was, the context is sort of washy on it. I'd still probably laugh because I think humor is supposed to cross the barrier of good taste and not good taste. And that by crossing the line, you know where morality stands. And you'll find over time that line moves. It's a flexible line. And if it's contracting at the moment or expanding or changing our perspective on things, that's what good comedy is supposed to do. So I think getting someone because they laughed at a joke is wrong. But if you said something specifically, like, I don't know, Alex Jones and a school event, apparently, then that will narrow you down and then bring that to light and get you banned. And that's just terrible. Anyway, that's what cancel culture is. But the whole segue here, Mackie, is about the virologist. So the Chinese virologist, Mackie, do you remember back in February, I think it was, that we brought up this because the questions had been raised and there was already information out there on the internet about the virus possibly being created in a lab in Wuhan, and that there was registered version of the virus that had four indicators that were different from the one today, meaning it had been worked on and those four things that changed that made it worse, and then it became a virus worth fearing if it were to become loose. And then we found, I think it was the NSA or NASA or someone's COVID there we go, I like that view of the actual lab that in September, I think, August or September last year in 2019, it had a lockdown on its own and no mobile phone services and movements of people with mobiles were going within a perimeter of the lab, which was claimed at the time that this was proof that the lab had been shut down. And this is what the evidence was that got the Five Eyes and the 30 other countries to agree that there should be an independent examination of the origin of the virus, that it was unlikely to have come from a wet market on its own, since the first cases documented had no exposure to the wet market at all. Never go anywhere near it, never been near it. So this is where that story, we broke this back in February. And so now the Chinese virologist has had their Twitter account suspended. But what I'm doing is questioning this. And I think, how could someone have their Twitter account suspended if there isn't any influence from the CCP, for instance? That's a question. How could it have occurred? See, I guess it's to my surprise that, if it was on Weibo, sure, that's geographically within China, but is Twitter? No, we know where Twitter comes out of. That data center that comes out of, it's probably Chinese owned. And in fact, then maybe they're examining all the traffic going through it. I don't know. So we're watching something very surprising occurring in the social media platform right now. So is it surprising that someone gets banned for saying something like that? No, not to me. But to me, the extent to which it's possible that the CCP is able to control its exhibit its force or its ownership or its bought people to be able to control our Western lives. That's what surprises me.
Does it really? I mean, it's actually easier these days to exert that kind of influence. Because before, think about the olden days. In the olden days, you actually had to go out there and burn books. That's a lot of work. Mm. That's a lot of work. And
Are there any stairs? Nuts to you.
No, but look, ultimately, though, these days, because the generation that's coming through since the mid-90s, since we had the internet, you know, and universal connectivity, it's going to get worse, by the way, in that space. They don't really go to books anymore, these people. People don't really read anymore. I'm a throwback. I read a lot of books constantly. I get my information from the net where I can, but not always. Yeah. However, it's a lot easier to control information, but more than information, you can much more easily control opinion. Right, because information used to be fact-based before in the olden days. Remember when information was actually meaningful?
I remember those days
when things actually made sense. And these days, though, because you can post whatever you like on the internet, you know, Wikipedia, YouTube, whatever it is, right?
Wikipedia, I dare you.
Yeah, that's right. Good luck with that. I tried that too. But the point is that you can influence opinion on a massive scale without any facts supporting you at all. You don't need facts anymore. You don't see information by the very term information means there's something there that is worthwhile knowing. There's worthwhile ingesting. Information these days is a lot harder to come by because there are a lot of opinions out there, opinions and deliberate falsehoods. And you have to sift through it, but most people don't. They just take it on face value that whatever is posted by someone they like or follow or respect or whatever it might be, they just believe that, right? So I think, especially if you keep the population in the dark and you make sure they don't have access to any other news sources or not very many news sources, it's very easy to completely keep people in the dark until the end of time. And that was really the nexus of 1984, the book, right? Yeah. Control the information, control the narrative, control the truth on a very granular level where you can actually make people say that 1 + 1 = 3, right?
Yeah, Jeremy Mackey, if there was a time machine, would you talk? I'd go back in time and talk to George Orwell and say, your book ends up being an instruction manual.
And he'll say, yeah, Dave, I know. Why do you think I wrote it?
I won't live to see it, so good luck with that.
Yeah, well, we don't know that idiot. No, but the thing is, he was actually a little more connected and in the know than a lot of people realize. Same with H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, George Orwell, a lot of the English writers were a lot more au fait with what was to come and the way things would shape themselves out. I don't know if you're familiar with future history or was it cycle history? The foundation cycle that Asimov wrote. Very interesting series of books, and I recommend it to anyone. Psychohistory. And this is really what these people are practicing. So psychohistory is really the projection of human development into the future. I mean, what's likely to happen? And the truth is, the more processing power you have, the more accurate the scenarios are that you can run. Mm-hmm. Now imagine having access to a superpower computer, maybe something that preceded our capability and our civilization, and that you're able to run scenarios. So people always ask me, Dave, how long have these plans been in place? How can the elite, you know, stay in power for so long and you know, people just don't get any wiser and et cetera, et cetera? And the answer is, I believe that they had access to world builder scenarios. Like if you play Civilization today, Sim or whatever these days, you know what I'm talking about. You can build these civilizations up, and the more processing power you have, the more information, the more data you can put into these simulations, let's call them, the more accurate they are. It's that simple. So I believe that these plans were put in place a very long time ago indeed, with branching probabilities, of course. You know, this happens, that happens, et cetera, et cetera, because some things you can't account for. Some things you simply can't account for, and it's just a random event, right? You can mathematically account for it, or you can try, but it's still hard to. It's like in the Matrix, Neo is the anomaly. He's the remainder of the equation that otherwise would be very beautiful.
That's right.
The problem is choice, Neo. Choice.
I love that bumper. Hey,
I want to move it on to the vaccine trial. And some news came out this week, which I was a bit surprised to see. Not astounded, but a bit of surprise. And it was about the wording. It was about the wording of this. So the Food and Drug Administration is weighing whether to follow British regulators in resuming a coronavirus vaccine trial that was halted when a participant suffered spinal cord damage, even as the National Institutes of Health has launched an investigation of the case. So despite there being an investigation underway, they're proceeding with the trial, even though it caused someone spinal cord damage. Granted that the person who had the spinal cord damage was it Alzheimer's? No, it wasn't Alzheimer's, the other one. Parkinson's or something?
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, something like that. I remember reading that in the article. And so that immediately strikes out those people with that disorder from ever being vaccinated if there wasn't a way to get around it. What a cleanse, Mickey.
Yeah.
You want people that were not, you know, genetically disposed to, you know, having Parkinson's. Well, they can't get the vaccine. They're all going to get wiped out. Do you know what I mean? So what a way of being able to cleanse the nation of, you know, the people I'm not saying we need to do it. I'm saying, wow, how extraordinary is that? Like, I'm certainly not going to be the first in the queue. And when they filled up the vial to jab my arm, I would step out the way and hold a politician in the way of the needle so that they weren't pretending and got a saline injection instead. Yes, I've been vaccinated when they hadn't. Lies, yeah. Right? Because, look, I fear it. I fear that I get my flu jab every single year. And I've always gotten my had all my inoculations as a kid. I had all everything else. I've got my scar on my arm from traveling as a kid. And just saying, this is the only one that I think if we rush it through and it avoids all of the normal testing and rigorous examination, that we're going to end up with something that does a lot more damage than the virus is going to do. Like, remember Agenda 21? Let's not forget what that means. About 500 million people left on the planet.
Correct.
No, it is. Yeah,
it
I know.
Is. I mean, so look, is this astounding? No, not really. Mm-hmm. But again, this is about battlefield triage, Dave. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is you must make the decision that is the greatest good mm-hmm. for the greatest amount of people, mm-hmm. right? That's how these decisions are made. Will people fall by the wayside? Oh, yeah, absolutely, right? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean for the context for the rest of? I mean, look, in fact, what if 7.2 billion people were to die and 500 million were to live?
Mm-hmm.
But then these 500 million, they would have a good life. Is that the right decision to make? Is that the wrong decision to make? Who makes the decision? Who could possibly make that decision?
Well, the rich would have still all the money, and whoever was left, it would, I think, just be fighting amongst ourselves as surface dwellers. We couldn't have everything we have ever wanted, because that would equalize us then with the elite. So we'd be on the treadmills.
Yeah, and people believe we're still in a living in a world restrained by resources. That's largely true, but not entirely true.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason diamonds are expensive is because not all the diamonds in the world are being released to the market. If the Russians, this is a fact. I'm a conspiracy factist, right? Not a theorist. If the Russians were to release all the diamonds they hold, the value of diamonds would drop to the value of gravel. But De Beers cut a deal with the Russians not to do that. So De Beers controls the diamond market. If the Russians were to release diamonds, De Beers would, that'd be a belly up, done, finished. Diamonds would be completely, worthless. It would be nice to look at them and hard, but they wouldn't have the scarcity value they have today. Similarly with other things, we think resources are scarce. We think that. But take a step back and look at the way Americans live, Europeans live, Australians live at large, even, Southeast Asians for argument's sake. And then you realize just how many resources there really are to go around. I mean, it's not limitless, but there's enough for everybody. There's more than enough. Simple example, Australia has got a population of about 25 million people, and we produce enough food for 75 million people. Mm-hmm. Okay, for argument's sake. Again, it's a fact. You can look that up yourself. Similarly, other parts of the world as well. I mean, we still destroy food every year. Why? Because if we released it into the market, the price would drop. The price would drop to a point where we can no longer make a profit.
It's called dumping.
Yeah, yep. It's dumping. And in fact, and not just, I mean, it's destroyed. It's actually into rubbish.
The release of that to the market is called dumping.
Yeah.
And
Yes.
And to get rid of it is we in English language we call that dumping as well. Yeah. Ironically.
Yeah. That's the way that they see it. You know, if you dump it, I'm not like the same as throwing it away because you're killing the price.
That's right.
And that's really the problem that we have here at large. That's where we're at, Dave. I mean, who makes these decisions, right? And to your point, we've been trained to believe that we're living in a society that is breaking under the burden of its population. Not true. Mm-hmm. Do away with all billionaires. Do away with all wealth that is concentrated in the few. And you mm-hmm. will see just how well people can live. Now, I'm not mm-hmm. a communist or socialist, but I do believe that we all have to have a social conscience. We as soon as we started living in cities or living together in any form of tribal organization or family organization, we have the obligation to look after each other. It's just how human beings function, right? And the few psychopaths at the top don't function that way. They don't give a hoot, not even a little bit. But yeah, sorry, to my point to your question, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all because these decisions are being made by people that just don't care. On a very simple basis, you know, if you work in a corporation, you're just a resource. You're just not even a person, you're a headcount. Right? Mm-hmm. If you're lucky.
You're like a device.
And if your usefulness is done, guess what? I'll see you later.
Right?
The human element is completely taken out of the equation. Capitalism has dehumanized us. Capitalism, and same as communism as well. I mean, any ism mm-hmm. will dehumanize us. Any ism will objectify.
Because it counts us as the greater number. That's all it does. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Mackie, I joined two stories together here because they're relevant and taken on their own, they're almost innocuous. But put together, there's something else into it. Okay, so the two stories are the semiconductor discussions held in Taiwan with the US. So the US flew an envoy out there to discuss the future of chip manufacturing and who can and who can't. There's that sound again. We'll get to that story, I promise you. So the semiconductors, right? And then the other one, China flies bombers. It'll make sense when you watch YouTube. China flies bombers over Taiwan. They happened on the same day. So while the US was there, a top US diplomat landed in Taiwan on Thursday, marking the second high-ranking visit of a senior Trump administration official to Taipei in 2 months at a time of historically low ties between Washington and Beijing. And there's a quote, "We feel that like-minded countries or fellow democracies need to pay more attention to this area and come to each other's help so that China's expansionist motivation can be deterred," says Mr. Wu. Mr. Wu told the France TV 24 station on Wednesday. So it was the day before. So then we have China flies bombers and fighters jets over Taiwan at the very same time as the envoy was there discussing it. So they went into scramble mode and had to scramble their jets because they went inside the airspace of Taiwan. So Taiwan's defense ministry said two bombers and 16 fighter jets flew into their air defense identification zone. Chinese defense ministry spokesperson, so they don't hear from Taiwan on this one, Ren, I can't pronounce his Kuojang, said that the exercises were a legitimate and necessary action taken in response to the current situation across the Taiwanese Straits to safeguard national sovereignty and territorial integrity, he said to AP. I understand why they did it, and I understand why the US is doing what they're doing, but it's certainly heating up the water, Maggie. The heat is under the pot with the pot on the boil. And like I said, we're seeing escalations. This action or both actions together are not a decline in that escalation.
Look, if you were China and mm-hmm. you knew that someone was coming into Taiwan to discuss whatever they're discussing, right?
Yeah.
Like a high ranking American official, I would have fighter jets flying over there as well. Say, hey, guy, you're in my country. Because the Chinese don't see Taiwan as a separate country. Taiwan, as far as they're concerned, is very much sovereign territory of China.
That's right.
And while it's a very complicated issue, it goes right back to the 1940s, mm-hmm. right? The 1930s,
yep.
really.
Yep.
When Chiang Kai-shek moved his Kuomintang into Formosa, now named Taiwan, and Mao Zedong, you know, and his Communist Party took the rest of mainland China. It's a very, very, very difficult situation. More complicated, believe it or not, than Vietnam or even Korea. But I would do the same thing. Hey, guys, hello. This is my country. So they view anything that happens in Taiwan as an internal affair. And the Americans sending some high-level delegates into Taiwan is of course, you know, a snap. It's like, hey, yeah, I can do whatever I want. China, what are you gonna do about it? So, it's tit for tat at this moment. We're at tit for tat.
I've got the King's initial song from Hamilton in my head.
Yeah,
you'll be back. You will see. I love that. It's in my head all the time now. So, look, the next story. It may not interest the US so much as it does me. But this was to do with the gas power generation is now on the table. And I found two articles that joined them together. And one was an astonishing about face, the Australian government has declared to the power industry and the public that it will make its own gas-fired plant if they don't. This comes on the same day as millions of dollars in donations were given or received by the government by the gas industry.
Is that a shock? Are you surprised?
Hang on. No, it's not a shock, and I'm not surprised by it. But I think we have to turn the word donation into bribe. There isn't any other way to say it. So,
that's illegal. They couldn't do that. It's illegal, isn't it?
Well, donation is legal and bribe isn't, right? Yeah. However, just because you call it a different word doesn't mean it's a different thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I'm but so naive, man.
That's almost doublespeak. That's what that is, right? We are living. See, people say, oh, 1984, what a terrible vision, Dave. What a terrible vision 1984 is. You're in it. You're living it, guys.
That's right.
That ship has sailed.
Hello.
what a terrible thing it would be if that were true.
Where are you?
Yeah. I laugh. This is haha. This is me laughing. I laugh.
Mackie and I have talked about this a lot, and the first thing is we need to remove all public money from governance because that's clearly corruption. It's corruption in so many ways. While it may not go straight into the coffers of an individual or benefit them in a way that, you know, they personally gain, their party gains and their party makes decisions based and has to take into account those donations. They couldn't suddenly, if you receive $20 million to your account as an organization, you can't just say, well, thanks for that. Good luck. We're going to do the opposite. Mm-hmm. They're going to go, hey, but what about that money we gave you? And we're going to go to the press. We're going to go, hey, we just donated all this money. We didn't get our way. Oh, no. We're in, you know, whatever the government wants, we'll support. Right? You can see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's never going to work. It doesn't matter how you think it works. You need to change your mind on it, I think, as a people. Because it's astonishing that in today's age that you're still able to send money to a political party to get favor. I don't know who. Oh, hell.
The biggest industry in Washington, Washington specifically, the District of Columbia, is lobbyism.
Okay. That lobby should be deleted. But anyway, I'll be shot or, you know, have to get my kids to start my car in a minute. So this leads into the next one. So remember Trump's plan to drain the swamp. And I've been looking it up, a bunch of this information this week and how that's coming. And I've come to a few questions. So I remember Trump promising to drain the swamp when he was elected or in his lead up to the election. And, well, the question really stands right now, how well has he done? That's a good question to raise, right? I wonder if the difficulty of draining the swamp for him has been that so many of these people that he's encountering are actually bought. So someone owns them or owns a concept or an item in which they can sway that person. Now, I'll give you an example because I don't think it's going to – that itself sounds – oh, Dave, that sounds corrupt, right, Mackie, right? But for instance, if you remember, if we take our minds back, set the Wayback Machine, right, for the early election, when Hillary Clinton was never actually pursued for the private email server that she had.
And that's interesting, isn't it?
And the emails on it. And then when she ordered it to be completely destructed by her own staff and they smashed it to smithereens so nothing could ever be gained from it, despite there being, oh, I can't remember the numbers now, I think it was sub 10, so like 9 different countries had hacked into it and extracted all the server emails off it anyway, right? And now she should all, so Hillary Clinton and in the pursuit of destructing of materials, then also would be a crime because you can't then provide that as evidence, even though it was called as evidence. My question is, how powerful are people and who do they control? Are the same people controlled by many different, you know, vectors in there? So how bought do you have to be? See, I handed it to Mackie and he goes, yep.
No, but that's...
They're valid questions, right? They're questions. Well, each one of those is a question.
See, the thing is, I don't want to say a lot about the Clintons.
No, right?
Okay. But like, suffice it to say, this is a general statement I'm making here, not anyone specific.
There we go, tap dance at Mackie.
Look at me. Look at him go! Oh, what wonderful footwork.
He's
young beyond his years. No, the truth is this. There are two sets of rules that we know about. And in fact, there are probably three or four sets of rules. There's one set of rules for the people that have no power, which is the vast majority. I mean, I'm talking about true power, right? Power is a control over your life and others, in other lives. Very few of us have true power over our lives or over the life of others. Whereas the other set of rules is for people that have the power, and they make the rules, and a different set of rules apply to them. So they're the laws that we all know, you know, the constitutions, blah blah blah, and bills of rights, and all that. If you are in the first group that has all the power, none of them is actually relevant to you because you're above that. Okay,
that's feudal, though, isn't it?
We've never moved out of it, mate. If you look at my favorite example of this, because it's the most extreme example of the model in recent times, is of course Jeffrey Epstein, when he was given the sweetheart deal to
work during the day and just go back to sleep in prison.
And no one ever in the history of the American legal system had ever gotten a deal like that. No one. Yeah. So the question is why him and why then and what and the people that gave him that deal, they're now in fairly high positions of power in the Trump administration. And not to mention Alan Dershowitz, his lawyer. I mean, if you think that these people aren't living in each other's pockets, you got another thing coming. They are absolutely living in each other's pockets. And I'm not astonished at all that all of these investigations fizzle out. Right. I mean, so once in a while you will need to put someone up there and hang him. Yeah, I know, fizzle, right?
I can't get past that. It's fine. Yes. I completely agree.
I mean, Epstein, for example, I mean, I knew that he would never see the inside of a courtroom ever, criminal courtroom, right? Ever. Because if he did, then the system that's in place would have to be put into operation. Because if at that point it wasn't working, then the people would see, oh, the system really is not working, right? So he had to be suicided, accident, whatever it might be. I'm still surprised that Ghislaine Maxwell, have you heard anything about her?
That's just here. Nothing. No, there's nothing.
Just, I don't, that, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, we'll all forget about that. Don't worry. You know?
Yeah. Oh, new cycle. Gillian, who? What?
Mickey, they're going to astroturf that, so we can't even find anything on the name.
Yeah. You know what? That's possible. Absolutely. In these days,
yeah, that's a thing. It's called astroturfing, by the way, yeah, everyone.
Absolutely. Completely.
So look, the last one was real simple, and the second last one, and then there's Kanye West. So anyone who is Gen, I think, or Gen Tech, maybe, I think, is his demographic, and he was denied permission to run in Wisconsin because of 14 seconds. That's it. So he was. They said he was still in the lift, riding lift to the floor where you had to provide the papers, and was delayed by the lift and missed by 14 seconds. That the deadline was by 5 p.m. and he was still in the 5 p.m. time. It hadn't hit 5:01. It was 5:14, and they denied him the access to be able to have his name on the ballot. He will still be able to have his name on the ballot of other places, maybe more, even more critical towns, but that's going to be certainly some challenge. I think the people who have their ballot office on the second floor and this lift operator van, you know, repair van out the front, I'd take the stairs. Because it might be that they tried to prevent him from making it.
Fire stairs on the outside of the building, take those.
Or maybe submit them the day before. That would be smart. You know, I had a friend of mine who used to think that everything was just too much time to take to do anything. One event per week was enough when he was unemployed. It was just too much schedule. And maybe Kanye's a little like that, you know, maybe a little disconnected, but, you know, his peeps should really get him on top of that. So, Mackie, the big news, though, was an 86-year-old who passed away this week.
Yeah, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was one of the Supreme Court judges, and in fact, probably not the most liberal, but certainly a stalwart of the liberal movement. She was appointed to the bench many decades ago, and her death is probably the vote that swings the balance, depending on who's appointed. And these are appointments, by the way, by the president, which have to be ratified by the government. By Congress, I think. But it's an appointment, and it could swing. And why is that important? Well, Roe v. Wade, which was the abortion case, or the right to give, you know, the case that gave women the right to, in fact, have an abortion, was Roe v. Wade, and it was upheld and has been upheld for a long time now. But if there were to be a swing in the composition of the bench of the Supreme Court, that could very well be overturned, and we could see things like that become certainly, and maybe not illegal, but certainly could be criminalized. So it could not be as easy to achieve as it was in the olden day or before that. So it's actually an important thing, and again. A lot of the bench is quite conservative, being appointed by Ronald Reagan, by Bush Senior and Junior. Quite a few of those judges were appointed during those presidencies. Not very many people appointed during the Clinton or Obama years.
Mm-hmm.
And now the strongest liberal voice for women's rights, etc., was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it could be a tectonic shift in American lawmaking and law interpretation.
So. Her now not being in the chair mm-hmm. would mean who would have an opportunity to appoint someone?
Well, the president. The president will put forward a nomination, right? And then it's ratified by Congress. There'd be an inquiry, et cetera, but I believe it's Congress that ultimately has to approve the presidential nomination. It's always appointed by president. Always.
Yeah, right. Well, it's, you know, before the election.
Well, it's interesting, right? The timing is and Dave and I discussed this prior to the show, and we're not saying either way. I mean, she was 87 years old and she'd have cancer and all that, but
that's right.
The timing of her passing is at the very least thought provoking. I'm not saying suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
But thought-provoking. Because
it comes at a time of an opportunity, then.
Yeah. If the Republicans thought that they could not win the second term, which is neither here nor there. And I want to say about something about this just in a second. Then it's certainly an opportune time to put a Supreme Court judge in there that would be what's the best word? Sympathetic to the conservative cause, right? And having said that, and I've got the family in the United States, all over, by the way, and the Trump v. I guess Democrats' decision in the election, upcoming election, has divided the nation. And I noticed from personal first-hand experience along family lines, similarly to the 1850s and 1860s, where abolitionism and emancipation, etc., divided people as well along family lines. We're saying the same thing again in this election between Trump and Biden, where people are divided amongst themselves in their families as to whom they should vote for.
Mm. Well, there's a few things there you don't talk about. One's religious, the other one is religion. Politics. Yeah, politics.
That's exactly right.
So, that always makes for a great Thanksgiving, which is your next celebration coming up, and is a dry run for Christmas. We don't celebrate that as much, but if you're a fan of eating two roasts a month apart, by all means do that. It usually gets too hot in Christmas here to do a roast because your house is baking, well, from the inside and the outside. So there's a deterrent here to do it. But I remember my candied yams, Mickey, when I was living over there, and there's the music. Oh, now I want candied yams. Have a great break. It's only very short. We'll see you back after with that for a continuation of our show, Shiny Side Out with Dave and Becky. And we'll be talking about physical, biological artifacts. Take the time to donate. And we'll see you soon.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
The little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
I will defend myself against their tyranny. Number 3 is my radio broadcast. I'm squarely in front of the public all the time, and they all know what's going on.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
Hello, my name is John Wayne, and I do a broadcast here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio, called The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
Freedom and fear are at war.
And folks, I assure you, we are in defense condition one. As we journey perilously through this paradigm that we currently reside in, and I ask that you join me every Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
We shall never surrender.
All right, thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
You're back with David Mackey's Shiny Side Out on freedomslips.com, on the number one listener-supported talk radio on the net. So push the donate button or subscribe to the archives for only, well, it's a Patreon account now. It's about $5 a month. If you're new to Shiny Side Out, welcome aboard. This is a tinfoil hat zone, so keep your arms within the vehicle. Turn off your personal reality inverters, and please, no flash photography. We are glad you're on board, so thank you for inviting us into your lives. So follow, subscribe, or otherwise for the appropriate social media platform. We are halfway through talking about, this is show number 444. Pause for Mackie. You might be muted. All right. 440 and 400, talking about physical biological artifacts. This is part 7 in our sequence or show arc, depending on where you're from. And since this is part 7, you probably want to collect or go back and review or listen to the other 6 parts that are prior to this. We hope that we've also made, and please comment below if you like it, please comment below in the YouTube. Also, we've split this into 2 chunks, so there's news and then there's a whole another hour of the show arc. So 1 hour is news, and it's consumable as news, and you can just subscribe. And the other one is the show arc topics. So get yourself some great merchandise from the station's website. An EMP-proof thumb drive, for instance. It has survival documents on it. You can get yourself seed packs. But follow the instructions clearly and understand your customs regulations so that you can avoid disappointment. For instance, in Australia, you can't import seeds because they can contravene our isolation policies, and the isolation ones are due to our quarantined for bugs and germs and things that could infect our crops. Now, we have one of the most isolated crop production facilities in the world, and we would like to keep those standards very, very high indeed, maybe exceed them. Now, Mackie, we're on, as far as I can see, we're on something like page something, or rather, I can see I made a note from last week, page 35, thereabouts, and South American Homo erectus.
Yeah, that's exactly where we are.
Yay.
Exactly right,
my
friend. Yay. Well done. And it's page 57, is it? No, it's not, sorry. 34, you're quite right.
Well, I'm on 35, so
good.
I do a bit of formatting as we go, so it's all good. All right, so look, Mackie, how about you take us through...
I will. Now, this is, again, extractions from the book that we shared with you before, and Cremo and Thompson, Hidden History of the Human Race, Forbidden Archaeology. I do recommend it to everybody. We're looking at some South American finds, which had some fairly unsettling implications. In 1970, so it's a fairly recent find, Canadian archaeologist Ellen Lyle Bryan found in a Brazilian museum a fossil skull cap with very thick walls and exceptionally heavy brow ridges, and were reminiscent of Homo erectus. The skull cap came from a cave in the Lagoa Santa region of Brazil. And Bryan showed photographs of the skull cap to several American physical anthropologists. They were unable to believe it could have come from the Americas, and proposed that it was either a fake, a cast, or possibly an old world skull cap that had somehow been introduced into the Brazilian collection examined by Bryan. But Brian counted that both he and his wife, who also saw the skull cap, had an abundant experience with human fossil bones. And they were both quite sure that the skull cap could not have been a fake or a cast. It was genuine. It was a genuine, highly fossilized human skull cap. That the Lagoa Santa calotte was not an old world fossil accidentally introduced into the Brazilian collection was supported, said Brian, by the fact that it differed in several important measurements from known old world skulls, making it unique as opposed to European skulls. What is the significance of the Lagoa Santa calotte? The presence of hominids with Homo erectus features in Brazil at any time in the past is highly anomalous. Paleoanthropologists holding standard views say that only anatomically modern humans ever came to the Americas. Okay, only Homo sapiens. Sapiens ever made it there. The methodology of science allows for views to change, but the kind of change inherent in accepting the presence of Homo erectus in the New World would be revolutionary. Okay. The Lagoa Santa skull cap mysteriously disappeared from the Brazilian Museum after it was examined by Brian. An important skeleton discovered by Hans Reck at Alduvai Gorge also disappeared from a museum. In the case of Brian's and Reck's discoveries, we at least had a chance to hear about them before they disappeared. But, one might suspect that other fossils have also escaped our attention because they were misplaced in museums or perhaps intentionally discarded without first having a report referring to them.
Mm. The Foxhall jaw. In 1855, a human jaw was discovered at Foxhall, England, by workers digging in a quarry. John Taylor, the town druggist, that's opposing all other vocations, purchased the Foxhall jaw from a workman who wanted a glass of beer. And Taylor called it to the attention of Robert H. Collier, an American physician then residing in London. Collier, having acquired the fossil, visited the quarry on Mr. Law's farm. He noted that the bed from which the jaw was said to have been taken was 16 feet below the surface. The condition of the jaw, thoroughly infiltrated with iron oxide, was consistent with incorporation in this bed. Collier said that the Foxhall jaw was the oldest relic of the human animal in existence. The 16-foot level at Foxhall is the same from the moire, later recovered stone tools and signs of fire. Anything found at this level would be at least 2.5 million, just repeating, million years old. Aware that he was in the possession of a fossil of great significance, Collier showed it to various English scientists, including Charles George Busk, Richard Owen, Sir John Prestwich, and Thomas Huxley. All of them were skeptical of its antiquity. Huxley, for example, objected that the shape of the bone did not indicate it belonged to an extinct or aberrant race of mankind, or aberrant. I'll get it. Here again, we encounter the mistaken belief that a modern-looking bone cannot be genuinely old. American paleontologist Henry Fairfield Osborne, writing in the 1920s about moire's finds of the flint tools in the same area where the Foxhall jaw was uncovered, wondered why the above-mentioned scientists did not take the trouble to visit the site. They disbelieved, said Osborne, probably because the shape of the jaw was not primitive. Also, the bone was not completely fossilized, but this is true of many other bones of similar age. After some time, the jaw mysteriously disappeared. It is almost never mentioned by modern authorities, and those who do mention it are invariably scornful. For example, we find in Fossil Men by Marcelin Boulle,
French person, I'm presuming, this statement. It requires a total lack of critical sense to pay any heed to such a piece of evidence as this. Wow, that is scornful. But many conventionally accepted bones and artifacts have also been found by uneducated workers. For example, most of the Homo erectus finds from Java were made by unsupervised paid native collectors. And the Heidelberg Homo erectus jaw was found by German workmen, whose former later turned it over to scientists. If scientists can seriously consider these discoveries, then why can they not seriously consider the fossil jaw as well? One might object that the Java Homo erectus fossils and the Heidelberg Homo erectus jaw are still available for inspection while the fossil jaw has vanished. But the original Peking Homo erectus fossils disappeared from China during World War II, yet they are still accepted as evidence for human evolution.
Because they fit the picture. See, this is...
That becomes more clear as we go along, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And maybe it's just an interjection very quickly here as to why this is the case, right? Because I mean, it's always the question, well, why would people be like this? When Darwin first came up with his theory of evolution, he faced an enormous uphill battle. Great, great piece of thinking he put together. Not original by himself, but, you know, he put together other people's work. And certainly being on the Beagle, it gave him some insights into adaptation and you know, what the natural world looks like all across the world. But evolution as such was a really groundbreaking and completely novel idea, because it flew in the face of the accepted belief that God created man and you know, everything else. And evolution was just a shocking thing. And more shocking was that man, us, you know, your Homo sapiens was meant to have evolved from ape-like creatures, something that sit very ill with the Victorians of the age, or other people for that matter on the planet. They just didn't like it. It was a bad idea, and they didn't like to be, you know, because that would mean that all human beings are essentially equal, right? Be they, you know, of African origin or European origin, et cetera, we're all pretty much the same. And clearly that wasn't the case in most people's minds at the time. So the Darwinists needed to be as dogmatic and as defensive as the church was in their beliefs, right? And they built a little wall, a little fortress around their belief system, because theory is a belief system, right? I mean, the theory is a theory. It's not fact. And Darwin was always hoping that the fossil record would bear him out. But the only thing that the fossil record has borne out is something that that is being referred to as punctuated equilibrium, something that has recently come, in my mind, probably should replace the steady state evolutionary theory. It just makes more sense. But there, you know, again, there's the issue of the prime mover and why do genes respond to outside pressures, et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah, it makes total sense.
Well, it does. But there's a problem, of course. You know, if you've got a theory and that it's just in its nascent state, and you've got a theory which is much stronger, which is the Christian theory at the time or the religious theory, you had to build a fairly strong fortress, and you can't allow anything that detracts from it. And once you say something is a certain way, any weakening of your position, saying things like, "Oh, maybe human race is a lot older," or whatever, maybe we are, you know, maybe we used to live together the same time as Neanderthal, et cetera, all of those admissions, right, which they would have been portrayed as, or failures of your original theory, would have been taken by the church or others as proof that evolutionary theory in totality is incorrect. Therefore, you cannot allow even the slightest crack in your armor, which of course flies in the face of science. But that's really where we are today. And people always say, "Oh, it's not science. Science wouldn't do that." Yeah, science would absolutely do that, because science is just people, guys. People. People are people. And they will always be people. Anyway. Which brings us to the Castelnuovo skeletons. Castelnuovo skeletons. Interesting. Millions of years ago, during the Pliocene period, a warm sea washed the southern slopes of the Alps, depositing layers of coral and mollusks. Late in the summer of 1860, Professor Giuseppe Ragazzoni, a geologist at the Technical Institute of Brescia, traveled to Castelnuovo, about 6 miles southeast of Brescia, to gather fossils or rather fossil shells in the Pliocene strata exposed in a pit at the base of a low hill, the Colle de Vento. Rizzoni reported the following. Searching along a bank of coral for shells, there came into my hand the top portion of a cranium, completely filled with pieces of coral cemented with the blue-green clay characteristic of that formation. Astonished, I continued the search, and in addition to the top portion of the cranium, I found other bones of the thorax and limbs, which quite apparently belonged to an individual of the human species. Rizzoni took the bones to the geologists A. Stoppani and G. Crioni. According to Rizzoni, their reaction was negative. Not giving much credence to the circumstances of discovery, they expressed the opinion that the bones, instead of being those of a very ancient individual, were from a very recent burial in that terrain. I then threw the bones away, stated Rizzoni, not without regret, because I found them lying among the coral and marine shells, appearing, despite the views of the two able scientists, as if transported by the ocean waves and covered with coral shells and clay. But that was not the end of the story. Rizzoni could not get out of his mind the idea that the bones he had found belonged to a human being who lived during the Pliocene. Therefore, he wrote, I returned a little later to the same site and was able to find some more fragments of bone in the same condition as those first discovered. In 1875, Carlo Germani, on the advice of Rizzoni, purchased land at Castelnuovo for the purpose of selling the phosphate-rich shelly clay to local farmers for use as fertilizer. Rizzoni stated, I explained to Germani about the bones I had found and strongly advised him to be vigilant while making his excavations and to show me any new human remains. In December 1879, Germani noticed some bones in his excavations, about 15 meters, about 49 feet, from the place where the first human bones were found. On January 2, 1880, Germani sent a message to Rizzoni about the discoveries. Rizzoni recalled, The next day, I went there with my assistant, Vincenzo Fracassi, in order to remove the bones with my own hands. The bones included pieces of the skull, some teeth and parts of the backbone, ribs, arms, legs, and feet. More discoveries were to follow. On January 25, Germani brought Rizzoni some jaw fragments and teeth. These were found about 2 meters, 7 feet, from the bones uncovered early in January. Rizzoni returned to Castelnuovo and found more fragments of skull, jaw, backbone, and ribs, as well as some loose teeth. All of them, said Rizzoni, were completely covered with and penetrated by the clay and small fragments of coral and shells, which removed any suspicion that the bones were those of persons buried in graves, and on the contrary confirmed the fact of their transport by the waves of the sea. On February 16, Germani advised Rizzoni that a complete skeleton was discovered. Rizzoni journeyed to the site and supervised the excavation. The skeleton, enveloped in a mass of blue-green clay, turned out to be that of an anatomically modern human female. The complete skeleton, said Rizzoni, was found in the middle of the layer of blue clay. The stratum of blue clay, which is over 1 meter, about 3 feet thick, has preserved its uniform stratification and does not show any signs of disturbance. He added. That was my repeat. The skeleton was very likely deposited in a kind of marine mud and not buried at a later time. For in this case, one would have been able to detect traces of the overlying yellow sand and the iron-red clay called ferretto. In short, any burial would have certainly produced a noticeable mixing of different colored materials in the otherwise undisturbed blue clay layer. And Rizzoni, a geologist, testified that there was no sign of such mixing. Also, the blue clay had its own stratification, which was intact. Rizzoni considered another possible objection to his conclusion that the human bones from Castelnuovo were as old as the Pliocene layer in which they were found. Perhaps streams had stripped away the layers covering the blue clay and penetrated partway into the blue clay layer itself. The human bones could then have been washed into hollows and new material could have been deposited over them. This could explain why there were no signs of burial. But Rizzoni said that it was unlikely that the human fossils had been washed recently into the positions in which they were found. The fossil remains discovered on January 2 and January 25 lay at a depth of approximately 2 meters. The bones were situated at the boundary between the bank of shells and coral and the overlying blue clay. They were dispersed, as if scattered by the waves of the sea among the shells. the way they were situated allows one to entirely exclude any later mixing or disturbance of the strata. Regazzoni further stated, the skeleton found on the 16th of February occurred at a depth of over 1 meter in the blue clay, which appeared to have covered it in a state of slow deposition. Slow deposition of the clay, which Regazzoni said was stratified, ruled out the hypothesis that the skeleton had recently been washed into the blue clay by a torrential stream. Modern geologists place the blue clays at Castelnuovo in the Ustian stage of the Middle Pliocene, which would give the discoveries from Castelnuovo an age of about 3 to 4 million years. In 1883, Professor Giuseppe Sergi, an anatomist from the University of Rome, visited Regazzoni and personally examined the human remains at the Technical Institute of Brescia. After studying the bones, he determined they represented four individuals, an adult male, an adult female, and two children. Sergi also visited the site of Castelnuovo. He wrote, I went there accompanied by Regazzoni on the 14th of April. The trench that had been excavated in 1880 was still there, and the strata were clearly visible in their geological succession. Sergi added the following. If a hole had been excavated for burial, then it would not have been refilled exactly as before. The clay from the upper surface layers, recognizable by its intense red color, would have been mixed in. Such discoloration and disturbance of the strata would not have escaped the notice of even an ordinary person, not to speak of a trained geologist. Sergio also noted that except for the almost complete female skeleton, most of the bones were dispersed among the shells and coral below the blue clay, as if across a single flat surface. This supported the view that these bodies had come to rest on the shallow sea bottom. When they decayed, their bones were scattered by the action of the water. The almost entirely preserved female skeleton, said Sergi, was not found in a posture indicating ordinary burial, but rather overturned. Sergi was convinced... Sergi was convinced that the Castelnuovo skeletons were the remains of humans who lived during the Pliocene period of the Tertiary. About the negative opinions of others, he said the following. The tendency to reject, by reason of theoretical preconceptions, any discoveries that can demonstrate a human presence in the Tertiary is, I believe, a kind of scientific prejudice. Natural science should be stripped of this prejudice. This prejudice was, however, not overcome, and it persists today. Mm-hmm. Sergi wrote the following. By means of a despotic scientific prejudice, call it what you will, every discovery of human remains in the Pliocene has been discredited. But Sergi was not alone in his acceptance of Regazzoni's discoveries at Castelnuovo. Armand de Quatrefagas, familiar to us from our review of stone implements, this is a part of the book that we haven't shared with you guys, also accepted them. Concerning the female skeleton uncovered at Castelnuovo, he said in his book, Races Humanes, or, you know, races or human races, there exists no serious reason for doubting the discovery of M. Regazzoni. And if made in the quaternary deposit, no one would have thought of contesting its accuracy. Nothing, therefore, can be opposed to it but theoretical a priori objections. So it's the theory that interferes with reality here, right? So there's in the scientist's mind, it is a certain way, and that's just how it is. That's the truth, and nothing ever shall move it. And then evidence comes along, physical evidence, that is contrary to that, and it is automatically dismissed because it is opposing the theory that's held in the scientist's mind. That's really what this means. In 1889, an additional human skeleton was discovered at Castelnuovo. This find introduced an element of confusion about the discoveries of 1880. Regazzoni invited G. Sergi and A. Issel to examine the new skeleton, which had been found in an ancient oyster bed. Sergi reported that both he and Issel believed this new 1889 skeleton to be a recent intrusion into the Pliocene layers because the almost intact skeleton lay on its back in a fissure of the oyster bed and showed signs of having been buried. But in his own paper, Issel went on to conclude that the 1818 discoveries were also recent burials. In a footnote, Issel claimed that Sergi agreed with him that none of the skeletons found at Castelnuovo were of Pliocene age. For the scientific community, this apparently resolved the ongoing controversy. But Sergi later wrote that Issel was mistaken. Despite his view that the 1889 skeleton was recent, Sergi said that he never given up his conviction that the 1880 bones were Pliocene. But the damage had been done, and Sergi was not up to fighting a new battle to rehabilitate the 1818 discoveries. Thereafter, silence or ridicule became the standard response toward Castagnetolo. A good example of the unfair treatment given to Castagnetolo, the Castagnetolo finds, may be found in Professor Arias McAllister's textbook of European archaeology, written in 1921. McAllister admitted that the Castagnetolo finds, whatever we may think of them, have to be treated seriously. He noted that they were unearthed by a competent geologist, Ragazzoni, and examined by a competent anatomist, Sergi. Still, he could not accept the Pliocene age. Faced with the uncomfortable facts, McAllister claimed there must be something wrong somewhere. what a great scientific conclusion. So, Dave, something to be wrong somewhere.
Yes.
First of all, the bones were anatomically modern. Now, if they really belonged to the stratum in which they were found, wrote McAllister, this would imply an extraordinary long standstill for evolution. It is much more likely that there is something amiss with the observations. McAllister also said the acceptance of a Pliocene date for the Castagnetolo skeletons would create so many insoluble problems that we can hardly hesitate in choosing between the alternatives of adopting or rejecting their authenticity. Now, just let's pause here for a second. This would imply an extraordinarily long standstill for evolution. Now, this was always one of the key objections that scientists had to finding these anatomically modern humans. But I want to, again, I know this is, we've brought this up many times, but, you know, it bears repeating here. The shark, the crocodile, and my favorite fish in the entire world,
the coelacanth,
have not changed. The coelacanth, first of all, hasn't changed at all in 60 millennia. Zero. Mm-hmm. So this is an extraordinary standstill in evolution, according to Dr. McAllister here, right? I mean, sorry, Professor McAllister.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there it is. It's a fact. You can stand on your head and dance around it as much as you want. The coelacanth hasn't changed in 60 million years. Secondly, while the shark and crocodile might have changed in size, right, shrinking, I guess, to today's sizes, they're still sharks and skeletons, and they're older than the coelacanth. Okay, they're hundreds of millions of years old, the crocodile and the shark, respectively. So, and it's always been my contention that if a species, and this is always assuming that evolution is a thing, if a species reaches optimal configuration, let's call it, why change? Why change? Why? What's the point? Why would you change, right? Because you should only, I mean, it's not survival of the strongest or the smartest, it's survival of the fittest. If your physical configuration is ideal or optimal for your survival, then you wouldn't change it. It makes no sense. Actually, it flies in the face of evolutionary theory, right? And that's notwithstanding that, you know, obviously the environment changes, but human beings have adapted to living anywhere on the planet, pretty much, right? So sorry, I just had to interject that here. I'll give you one more sentence, and then I'll hand it over to my esteemed co-host. Here, once more, we find a scientist's preconceived ideas about evolution influencing him to reject skeletal evidence that would otherwise be considered of good quality. Right? Again, people's mindset, and this is confirmation bias of the worst kind. This is confirmation bias. Sorry, it's the opposite of confirmation bias. If your evidence, your physical evidence, does not coincide with my preconceived idea, I will reject it. The same thing Robert Schoch faced when he discussed the age of the Sphinx. Same thing, exactly the same thing. Sorry, Dave, tell us about McAllister.
McAllister cited Issel in support of his attempt to discredit all of the Castagnetolo finds, even though Issel's 1889 report really discredited only the 1889 skeleton. For example, McAllister, referring to all of the Castagnetolo finds, wrote, Examination of the bones and their setting by Issel and Geneva revealed that the fact that the strata were full of marine deposits and that everything solid within them, except the human bones, showed marine incrustations. While it is true that Issel reported that the bones of the skeleton uncovered in 1889 were smooth and free of
in crustaceans. The same cannot be said of the earlier discoveries, which both Ragazzini and Sergi said were encrusted with blue Pliocene clay and pieces of shells and coral. Another example of the unfair treatment given the Castanedello discoveries is found in fossil men. In this book, Boulle and Vallus, stated that it seems certain that the Castanedello, we are dealing with more or less recent burials. But in fossil men, Boulle and Vallus devoted only one paragraph to Castanedello and did not mention the undisturbed layers lying over the skeleton or the scattered and incomplete state of some of the skeletons, information that tends to rule out intrusive burial. Boulle and Vallus, I can't even say that in French, noted in 1889 the discovery of a new skeleton was the subject of an official report by Professor Issel, who then observed that the various fossils from this deposit were impregnated with salt, with the sole exception of the human bones, where Boulle and Vallois implied that that was true of the bones found in 1889 was also true of the bones found previously. But in his 1889 report, Issel described only the bones found in 1889. In fact, Issel did not even mention the word salt, referring instead to marine incrustations, which were, as above mentioned, present on the bones found in 1860 and 1880. Scientists have employed chemical and radiometric tests to deny a Pliocene age to the Castanedello bones. Fresh bones contain a certain amount of nitrogen in their protein, and this tends to decrease with time. In a 1980 report, K.P. Oakley found the Castanedello bones had a nitrogen content similar to that of bones from the late Pleistocene and Holocene. Italian sites and thus concluded the Castanedello bones were recent. But the degree of nitrogen preservation in bone can vary widely from site to site, making such comparisons unreliable. As age indicators, the Castanedello bones were found in clay, a substance known to preserve nitrogen containing bone proteins. Bones tend to accumulate fluorine from groundwater, but that also depends on the quantity of fluorine in the water. The Castanedello bones had a fluorine content that Oakley considered relatively high for bones he thought were recent. Oakley explained this discrepancy by positing higher past levels of fluorine in the Castanedello groundwater, but this was simply guesswork. The Castanedello bones also had an unexpected high concentration of uranium, consistent with great age. A carbon-14 test yielded an age of 958 years for some of the Castanedello bones. But, as in the case of Galley Hill, the methods employed are now considerably unreliable, and the bones themselves, which had been mouldering in a museum for almost 90 years, were likely contaminated with recent carbon, causing the test to yield a falsely younger age. The case of the Castanedello demonstrates that shortcomings of methodology employed by paleoanthropologists, the initial attribution of a Pliocene age to the discoveries of the 1860 and 1880, appears justified. The finds were made by a trained geologist, Gio Ragazzoni, who carefully observed the stratigraphy at the site he especially searched for signs of intrusive burial and observed none. Ragazzoni duly reported his findings to his fellow scientists in scientific journals. But because the remains were modern in morphology, they came under intense negative scrutiny. As McAllister put it, there had to be something wrong. The account of human origins, now dominant in the scientific community, is the product of attitudes such as McAllister's. For the last century, the idea of progressive evolution of the human type from more ape-like ancestors has guided the acceptance and rejection of evidence. Evidence that contradicts the idea of human evolution is carefully screened out. Therefore, one who reads textbooks about human evolution, one may think, well, the idea of human evolution must be true because all the evidence supports it. But such textbook presentations are misleading, for it is the unquestioned belief that humans did in fact evolve from ape-like ancestors that has determined what evidence should be included and how it should be interpreted. Mackie?
Yeah, and unfortunately, Dave, that is completely true, to the point where, like I explained earlier, this dogmatism is hurting us now. And look, in fact, it is now a foregone conclusion that we've evolved from apes, and as recently as 300,000 years ago. There's an article recently which we will share with you as part of the show cycle, and it talks about the most ancient Homo sapiens skeleton officially found was in Morocco, and it's 300,000 years old, which was 100,000 years older than previously thought. So if it takes baby steps to push us back further and further in the past, then so be it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But I firmly believe that we will find eventually enough evidence. Look, I think we already have found the evidence, but we'll find enough acceptance in the scientific community that the human race has been on this planet in one form or another
mm-hmm.
for a very long time indeed. Okay, and we're only scratching the beginning here, the first layers. And see, it's not only the miners or regular workmen whose testimony is being discounted, because these are trained geologists and trained physiologists and anatomists and anthropologists. It is also their testimony, if it flies in the face of accepted science, is also discounted, right? So we can't use the excuse here that, oh, you know, we know that these are just laymen, amateurs, and you can't trust what they say anyway. But if you've got scientists involved, then you have to think a little harder. And as McAllister put it, there has to be something wrong, clearly. I mean, it has to be, because it's modern morphology. It cannot possibly be this. It cannot be what the evidence says it is. Which brings us to the Savona skeleton. We now turn our attention back to another Pliocene find, which was made at Savona, and it's a town on the Italian Riviera. Beautiful place, about 30 miles west of Genoa. In the 1850s, while constructing a church, workmen discovered an anatomically modern human skeleton at the bottom of the trench, 3 meters, about 10 feet deep. The layer containing the skeleton was 3 to 4 million years old. Arthur Issel, again, communicated details of the Savona find to the members of the International Congress of Prehistoric Anthropology and Archaeology at Paris in 1867. He declared that the Savona human was contemporary with the strata in which he was found. De Motilet, however, wrote in 1883 that the Pliocene layers at Savona, deposited in shallow coastal waters, contained isolated bones of land mammals while the human skeleton was largely intact. Does this not prove, he said, that instead of the remains of a human cadaver tossing in the waves of the Pliocene Sea, we are simply in the presence of a later burial of undetermined date? At the International Congress of Prehistoric Anthropology and Archaeology at Bologna in 1871, Father Deo Gratias, a priest who had been present at the time of the discovery of the human skeleton at Savona, gave a report indicating that it was not an intrusive burial. Deo Gratias, a student of paleontology, noted the body was discovered in an outstretched position, with the arms extending forward, the head slightly bent forward and down, the body very much elevated relative to the legs, like a man in the water. Can we suppose the body was buried in such position? Is it not, on the contrary, the position of a body abandoned to the mercy of the water? The fact that the skeleton was found on the side of a rock in the bed of clay makes it probable that it was washed against this obstacle. Deo Gratias further stated, had it been a burial, we would expect to find the upper layers mixed with the lower. The upper layers contain white quartzite sands. The result of mixing would have been that if the definite lightening of a closely circumscribed region of the Pliocene clay sufficient to cause some doubts in the spectators that it was genuinely ancient, as they affirmed. The biggest and smallest cavities of the human bones are filled with compacted Pliocene clay. This could only have happened when the clay was in a muddy consistency during Pliocene times. Deo Gratias pointed out that the clay was now hard and dry. Also, the skeleton was found at a depth of 3 meters, again 10 feet, which was rather deep for burial. The combination of fossils found at Savona can thus be explained as follows. The site was once covered by a shallow shoreline, by the shallow shoreline waters of a Pliocene sea, as shown by the presence of characteristic shells. Animals could have died on the land, and their isolated bones could have been washed into the sea and incorporated into the formation. The human bones found in a natural connection could have come to rest in the same marine formation as a result of someone drowning there during the Pliocene, perhaps after the sinking of a boat. This accounts for the presence of a relatively complete human skeleton amid scattered animal bones without recourse to the hypothesis of recent intrusive burial. Keeping in mind that the posture of the skeleton face down and with limbs outstretched, was like that of a drowned corpse rather than one deliberately buried.
Yes. Monte Hermoso Vertebra. In chapter 5 of the book, which I'm sure we'll understand which book, we discussed the discovery of flint tools and signs of intentional use of fire at Monte Hermoso in Argentina. Now we will consider the human bone found there. An atlas, the topmost bone of the spinal column. Santiago Pozzi, an employee of the Museum of La Plata, collected it from the early Pliocene Monte Hermosan formation during the 1880s. It did not attract much notice until years later. At that time, it was still covered with the characteristic yellowish-brown loess of the Monte Hermosan formation, which is 3-5 million years old. That bone lay for years in a museum before it was recognized. That bone lay for years in a museum before it was recognized should not disqualify it. The Gibraltar skull lay for many years in the Garrison Museum before it was recognized as a Neanderthal specimen. Also, several Homo erectus femurs from Java were shipped to Holland in boxes of bones. They went unrecognized and uncatalogued for several decades, but are now listed in textbooks with other accepted finds. The number of similar cases could be expanded, the point being that scientists have become aware of many fully accepted fossil finds in the same way as the Monte Hermoso Atlas. After the Pliocene loess was removed, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm just pretending that's what it is, scientists carefully studied the bone. Amegino, accepting that it was truly Pliocene, assigned the atlas to an ape-like human ancestor. In his description of the bone, he identified features he thought were primitive. But Alice, Herdlicker?
Perfect.
Convincingly demonstrated that the bone was actually modern in form. Like Herdlicker believed the human form should as we proceed back in time, become more and more primitive, according to Hrdlicka. If a bone was of the fully modern human type, then no matter what layer it was found in, it had to be of recent origin. Such a bone's presence in an ancient stratum always could be, indeed had to be, explained as some kind of intrusion. There is, however, another possible explanation. Human beings of the modern physiological type were living over 3 million years ago in Argentina. This is supported by the fact that the atlas showed signs of having been thoroughly embedded in sediments from the Monthermosen formation. And in all, Hrdlicka felt that the Monthermosa atlas was worthy of being dropped of necessity into obscurity. That is exactly what happened. Otherwise, Hrdlicka's claim that humans only recently entered the Americas would have been placed on a very shaky ground. Today, there are many who also insist that the Monthermosa Atlas remain in the obscurity into which it was of necessity dropped. Evidence for a fully human presence 3 million or more years ago in Argentina, of all places, is still not welcome in mainstream paleoanthropology.
And that's a fact.
Yeah.
Right? No, that's it. The Miramar jaw. In 1921, M.A. Vignati reported that a human lower jaw with two molars was discovered in the late Pliocene. Chapadmalalan formation at Miramar in Argentina. Previously, stone tools and a mammalian bone with an arrowhead embedded in it had been discovered at this site. And the book refers to this in Chapter 5. The jaw was discovered by Lorenzo Parodi, a museum collector. E. Bowman reported that Parodi found the jaw and its attached molars embedded in the barranca at great depth in the Chapadmalalan strata at about the level of the sea. The jaw would thus have been about 2 to 3 million years old. Bowman, however, was skeptical. He stated, "The newspapers published bombastic articles about the most ancient human remains in the world, but all who examined the molars found them to be identical to the corresponding molars of modern human beings." Bowman took it for granted that the fully human nature of the Miramar jaw fragment unequivocally ensured its recent date. But nothing Bowman said excludes the possibility that the Miramar fossil demonstrated fully human presence in the Pliocene of Argentina. Again, because the physical find didn't agree with the mindset theories held in the scientist's mind, it must therefore be a recent find. It had to be an intrusion, clearly. Dave.
That's absolutely true, and I'm just typing a post. Terrible. Okay, the Calaveras skull. In Chapter 5 of the book that we're aforementioned book, we discuss the numerous stone implements discovered in the Afurius Ariferous gravels of the Sierra Nevada mountains of California, which I've been to. Human bones were also found in these gravels, which range from 9 million to 55 million years old. That's such a long time ago. That's wow.
Longest to mine, right?
Yeah, right.
Shouldn't,
only because it goes against everything we've been indoctrinated to believe. I repeat, the history books that I learnt from were reprinted in 1956. Nothing new, despite their wherever their original author date, their print date was. Anyway, in February 1866, Mr. Madison, the principal owner of the mine on Bald Hill near Angels Creek in Calaveras County, removed a skull from a layer of gravel 130 feet below the surface. The gravel was near the bedrock, underneath several distinct layers of volcanic material. Volcanic eruptions began in this region during the Oligocene, continued through the Miocene, and ended in the Pliocene. Since the skull occurred near the bottom of the sequence of interspersed gravel and lava layers at Bald Hill, it would seem likely that the gravel in which the skull was found was older than the Pliocene, perhaps much older. After finding the skull, Madison later carried it to Mr. Schreibner, an agent of Wells Fargo and Co.'s Express at Angels. Mr. Schreibner's clerk, Mr. Matthews, cleaned off part of the incrustations covering most of the fossil. Upon recognizing that it was part of a human skull, he sent it to Dr. Jones, who lived in a nearby village of Murphy's and was an enthusiastic collector of such items. Then Dr. Jones wrote to the office of the Geological Survey in San Francisco. After receiving a reply, he forwarded the skull to this office, where it was examined by J.D. Whitney, the state geologist. Whitney at once made the journey to Murphy's and Angels, where he personally questions Mr. Madison, who confirmed the report that was given by Dr. Jones. Both Schreibner and Jones were personally known to Whitney and were regarded by him as trustworthy. On July 16, 1866, Whitney presented to the California Academy of Sciences a report on the Calaveras skull, affirming that it was found in the Pliocene strata. The skull caused great sensation in America. According to Whitney, the religious press in this country took up the matter and were quite unanimous in declaring the Calaveras skull to be a hoax. Whitney noted that the hoax stories did not arise until after his discovery was publicized widely in newspapers. Some of the hoax stories were propagated not by newspaper writers, but by scientists such as William H. Holmes of the Smithsonian Institution. There's another one, Maggie. During a visit to Calaveras County, he gathered testimony from some people who were acquainted with Mr. Schreibner and Dr. Jones, and this testimony raised the possibility that the skull examined by Whitney was not a genuine tertiary fossil. But there is a problem with the hoax hypothesis there. Are many versions. Some religious miners planted the skull to deceive the scientist Whitney. Some say the miners planted a skull to deceive another miner. Some say a genuine skull was found by Madison and later a different skull was given to Whitney. Some say Madison's friends from a nearby town planted a skull as a practical joke. This contradictory testimony cast doubt on the hoax idea. After visiting Calaveras County, Holmes examined the actual Calaveras skull at the Peabody Museum in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and concluded that the skull was never carried and broken in a tertiary torrent, that it never came from the old gravels in the Madison mine, and that it does not in any way present a tertiary race of men. Some testimony supporting this conclusion comes from persons who examine the matrix of pebbles and earth in which the Calaveras skull had been discovered. Dr. F.W. Putnam of Harvard University's Peabody Museum of National History said the skull did not bear any trace of gravel from the mines. Remember, it was cleaned. William J. Sinclair of the University of California also personally examined the skull and said that the material attached to it was not gravel from the gold mine. He said that it was kind of material one might find in a cave where Indians sometimes place bodies. On the other hand, Holmes reported Dr. D. H. Dahl states that while in San Francisco in 1866, he compared the material attached to the skull with portions of the gravel from the mine and that they were alike in all essentials. And W.O. Ayres writing in the American Naturalist in 1882 stated, "I saw it and examined it carefully at the time when it was first reached Professor Whitney's hands. It was not only encrusted with sand and gravel, but its cavities were crowded with the same material, and the material was of a sort which I had occasion to know thoroughly. It was," said Ayres, "the gold-bearing gravel that found in the mines, not a recent cave deposit." Look, it's going to be a bit long for the rest of that story, Mackie. We only have 1 minute, I think, two left, so...
Okay, maybe let's just we won't be able to finish it. Let's just start on that story again next time, the Calavera skull. Look, I think it is fairly clear here, and I do really commend the research that Cremo and Thompson undertook to write their book. Not really pushing an agenda, but just asking questions. I mean, none of this is really necessarily drawing you one way or another, I hope. I mean, you make up your own mind. We'll share the information with you in the same way that Cremo and Thompson did, and you can go back to the primary sources. But this is no longer just a story of miners and workmen finding stuff in the earth. These are now scientists that have fairly entrenched positions on these subjects, and some that made the finds think, oh, wow, this is amazing. And it's not just one or two. There are many of these finds that were made. But if you go through the literature today, you will find that they all, either they've gone into obscurity or they're dismissed as hoaxes or dismissed as misrepresentations. And so none of them actually made it into the record, because our consistent story is that the human race, as it is today, is not that old. That's the simple thing here. And what I found astounding, Dave, why would anybody not want to examine this further and give credence to the fact that the human race is in fact a lot older? I mean, if you go to India and you look at the Vedic teachings, etc., you'll find that they have no issue at all with the human race being millions and millions of years old at all, right? It's really astounding that such a knowledge wall exists. And there's the music. Look, hopefully you enjoyed the show today. Gerber, I'm sure, coming up with an awesome roundtable in a moment, so please don't go anywhere. And if you have time to tune in next week, please do. We're going to keep on going with this stuff.
Thank you for listening to Revolution.